Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Petrovich, may it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of Whitney Bradley and Brown, the plaintiff in this action and the appellant. This is a RICO case.
That's the question, isn't it?
It's a claim. It's a RICO claim. This is not an ordinary business fraud case. This is not a case where an employee started a side company, is moonlighting, budgeted his expense reports, only did a few of them, maybe exaggerated his working time. This is a case where we have 30,000 emails on Mr. Cameraman's work WBB email that shows that he started premeditatedly in 2006, started another company, and intended in 2006 to continue
to take your allegations that he committed fraud and on a genuine basis to the tune of about $14,000, and that this was basically using false timesheets. Over a period of time. The question I think this raises is whether this conduct can also be called racketeering statute. I suppose my first question is, do we have a case where one victim has sued one perpetrator under RICO?
Well, I mean, I think the Seventh Circuit in the Liquid Air case did. I think the case, and we cited it in our brief.
The Seventh Circuit and Morgan said that one of the important factors is the number of perpetrators and the victims.
Well, I think those are for close-ended. Those are important factors. But
you
here
have
we have
a case where you have one victim and one perpetrator.
Well, it depends
under
on how
RICO?
You. Pardon, Your Honor.
Under RICO.
We do. We have the professionals versus Barry's case, and that is one company, the professionals. Just like we have one company, WBB, in professionals, you had 16 investors, and here you have 150 ESOP participants, stockholders. And
investors there. Here you have one company and one employee.
But you have one company and professionals, and there's people make companies. And in here we have a company that 150 ESOP participants own the company.
Well, that makes every little claim by IBM against one of its employees RICO.
Well,
IBM's got a lot of investors.
Do you go through and look and see how many stockholders there are in a company that's on the New York Stock Exchange?
No, I think that the cases say that it's a factor, it's not a determining factor. I think what's at issue here is what the scheme was. We could talk about expense. It wasn't expense reports.
The scheme was to fraud, defraud you all. Right? False expense reports?
No.
False timesheets?
No.
It's all mail fraud and wire fraud?
No. That's what opposing counsel will have you believe.
Well, what is
that? Those are the predicate acts.
Well, that's what the predicate acts. And you allege that that constitutes racketeering activity.
No.
No.
No. Here's what I'm saying. Here's
you
what I'm saying.
You better get yourself clear. You're,
well, we did in our brief.
You're throwing out a lot of stuff here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to answer your questions.
I was reading out of your complaint, I think.
Okay. Here, our case here on RICO is that he had a premeditated multi-year plan to bilk WBB and the ESOP participants out of over $500,000.
Is that fraud?
It is, but the timesheets and the expense reports are nothing but his way of deceiving them to steal over $500,000. It's not the expense report.
So you have an employee that embezzles $10 million through a very elaborate scheme, and the employer sues the employee for RICO because the employer has a lot of investors.
It depends. Not because they have investors. It's because of the way he goes about it. He does it to benefit another entity, which you don't have in that case. If he's just embezzling it for himself, it's not a RICO case. And here he was doing it to help CLK and his family business. And
not him.
Pardon?
Not
and his family and his wife. He's got other people in it.
He takes
like the
all his fraud proceeds. Everybody who has fraud takes it home and gives it away to his girlfriends and his family and his cars and everything else. I mean,
possibly. His family was in his other business, though. Like the Berries. The professionals and the Berries is a perfect case the Berrys deceived the professionals into thinking they were doing work for them when they weren't. And here's Mr. Cameron. What he was doing is he was inside the company, and he would go on these expensive trips. He would take all the profits that he made from those getting new clients and shift them over to his other company. And what he would do is he'd take work product. The military had all these documents this high, taking these documents from important military work product that WBB did, and he would take this stuff and he would email it to his other clients. He would try to steal our clients and send them over to his other business. He was doing this over a multi-year period, and he was deceiving them into thinking he was working for them when he was spending all his time, virtually all his time, with his other company. Look at the times for February. He has another employment contract for Schiebel saying he's going to work for them. He flies to Vienna and back after a business trip to Schiebel, bills WBB for all his time, says he's working for WBB for his travel. He bills hundreds of hours with these other companies, doing all his work for these other companies, and lied to his employer that he was doing any work for them while he was stealing their clients and stealing their profits. This is the most outrageous case of business fraud I've heard of as an employment lawyer. What he did here is so underhanded. He stole.
How can you say that's the most outrageous case?
That I've handled.
A little bit of hyperbole.
No, this is the most outrageous case of an employee for a company engaged in defrauding his employer that I've handled.
A $14,000?
No, this is not a $14,000 case. He was not working for WBB for 2.5 years. We have concrete evidence that he was spending all his time working for his other company, sending all the profits he made at our company to the other company, and he was taking over $500,000 from our company.
You're saying a benefit that otherwise would have occurred.
No, we're talking about his salary, his 401k,
right.
His stock options. All his compensation. He was stealing all his compensation.
I know, but people do that all the time. I don't understand why this isn't a garden variety crime.
Because
you're really
people,
having trouble. Because it seems to me you've got to show a pattern of profiteering activity in the meaning of the case.
I agree with
that. And how do you show that in the meaning of our case?
First of all, people don't do. I hope people don't do this all the time. He
well,
was working all his time.
Yeah.
He was working virtually all his time, lying to his company that he was working for them, and working virtually all his time with his other company, and he did it premeditatedly. We have emails from him.
Yeah, let me just catch up though. I've seen hundreds of these cases, okay, over my career as a judge, hundreds. So what makes this one different?
I've had many cases, and I've never filed a RICO count where somebody's moonlighting and doing work on the side. I've had hundreds of those cases too, Your Honor. I've had many cases where people steal clients and send them to another company when they're moving on. I've had many cases where people steal work product and use it illegally for their own. I've never had a case where an employee has an email in 2006 saying he's going to intentionally do all his work
well,
for another company.
Every mail fraud scheme is premeditated. It's a scheme. It's an illegal criminal scheme under 1331, which, you know, you can be prosecuted if you bring suit. Garden variety fraud, that's what they've said, a lot of these things. Unless you can bring it, expand it out to get it under the RICO.
Your Honor, if you believe that this is a case about garden variety fraud where somebody's falsifying expense reports and just fudging their time, then you have to rule for the other side. But if you see this as a case where somebody is using... He's lying to his company and defrauding them out of all his compensation while he's stealing their clients. When he goes on business trips for them, he takes all the profit and all the new company and clients that he receives and puts them onto his other company, where he takes their work product and sends it to the other company, where he's spending all his time doing that. All I can say is that is an intentional, multi-year, premeditated plan to rip a company up, to build them of over $500,000, while he was also stealing about $175,000 a year in new business to his other companies. I mean, this is an extreme case of just racketeering activity, intentional, multi-year, and premeditated.
You have a case where an employer sued an employee for frauding the company and not sued the RICO claim?
No, Your Honor, the closest case we have is the professionals in the Berry case where they hired the Berries to run this company, and they trusted them to do all this work for them, and they submitted false invoices for expenses, and they submitted false time for work they didn't even do. And that case is as close to a case as we could find, and that's by the Fourth Circuit. And it was on the strength of that case that we believe that this is at least a case that should go to trial and should overcome summary judgment and let the facts come out as they do.
How many investors were there in Berry's?
There were 16 on behalf of professionals. And we have 150 ESOP participants.
No, that's not. He was defrauding the investors, correct? This is an unpublished opinion.
That's true.
But he was defrauding the investors, and this is defrauding the company.
I understand, Your Honor, and I understand that distinction. I understand that distinction, Your Honor.
Okay. Anything further?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have some rebuttal, Mr. Cortland.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is David Cordling, and I'm on behalf of the defendant appellee, Christian Cameron. Your Honor, this is, as the Court has hinted, nothing more than an ordinary garden variety fraud on both parties, and it's not the type of case that deserves federal RICO treatment. I'd like to first address one specific question that the Court as opposing counsel, which is whether or not there's ever been a RICO case involving one perpetrator and one victim. And counsel cited to the Liquid Air case. That case was pre-HJ Inc. when the Supreme Court gave a better definition of what it takes to establish a continuing pattern. Excuse me. And since that case, the Seventh Circuit has never identified another case after H.J. Inc. involving one perpetrator and one victim. In this circuit, we have the Alaboud case, the Anderson case, the Flip Mortgage case, and Manasco, where the Court has said one perpetrator, one victim is an indication that it's not a RICO case. And that's exactly what we have here, one perpetrator.
How do you distinguish Berry?
Several different ways. First of all, with Berry, you have 16 investors who were defrauded directly as opposed to one company that was defrauded in business. Second of all, in Berry, you had the perpetrators went out and solicited these investors to get their money. It wasn't an employment relationship where somebody's brought in their employer. They went out, solicited these investments to get this money, and then engaged in a much wider variety of predicate acts as opposed to just mail fraud and wire fraud. They submitted false financial statements. They formed dummy corporations. They did these land transactions where they were able to acquire land for less than the value. But it was a much more far-reaching scheme as opposed to one where you just got somebody who's defrauding you. There are, I think, four things that really stand out in this case, and all of this comes from the complaint. When we look at the variety of predicate acts, mail fraud and wire fraud, and what they've alleged essentially are these fraudulent expense reimbursements and the fraudulent timesheets. The expense reimbursements that occurred over a period of 1 year, 14 separate occasions of about $13,800, give or take. In addition to that, though, they claim that my client submitted all these fraudulent timesheets, and that based on that, he stole profits and money. he was not an hourly employee, his salary. If he's fudging his timesheets, he was still working for WBB. They admit they produced $2.3 million in business over these 3 years, still performing services. So if he's submitting fraudulent timesheets, that's not causing any injury to WBB. They may contend that if they had known what his actual hours were, that they would have terminated him. They can't show any, they cannot quantify any amount of damages that they suffered as a result of any fraudulent timesheets. The second thing that I think is important, and this comes straight from the complaint, is that this scheme, as alleged by WBB, has an end point to it. It has a goal. They alleged in their complaint, and I'll quote, that he would continue to receive his salary from WBB and build a profit to CLK to the point where it could financially support him. At that point, Cameron intended to resign from WBB. And we know from the U.S. airline pilots case that was recently decided here that when there is a scheme that has a definite endpoint, there is no threat of continuity. There is no threat that this is a scheme that will go on into the future because there is a goal to it. The goal, according to their own allegations, is that he wanted to start up the side business, get to a point where he could quit WBB and then work full-time for his side business. And if that is their allegation, if that is the goal, that's the end of the game right there. This is not an open-ended scheme. It has a definite impact. And in the joint appendix, there are a number of stipulations where they refer to my client's own emails where he says, I'm getting ready to leave. I intend to leave by the end of the year, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no threat of continuity. The third thing that stands out in this is the predicate acts are mail fraud and wire fraud. As this court has stated repeatedly, it's the rare fraud that does not employ the use of wire or mail, at least at some point during the course of the fraud. That comes from the Al-Abood case, the recent case where the court observed that the Fourth Circuit is hesitant to find RICO just based on allegations of mail fraud and wire fraud because it's relatively easy to establish that fraud, and that's relatively common in any scheme. and fourth, the thing that stands out, and I've touched on this before, is the number of victims. We've got one victim here, which is WBB, not 150 ESOP participants or investors, et cetera. The court asked counsel before if there was ever an occasion where an employer sued an employee for fraud, embezzlement, anything like that based on racketeering. I've not found one. Counsel has not found one. The closest one that we can find is the Berry case, which is completely different from this case. That was widespread fraud directly to the investors. And again, you have the plaintiff there going out.
It was a real estate investment trust? Or?
It wasn't a real estate investment trust, but it was real estate dealing. They were purchasing real estate and managing it. But again, in that point, you have direct solicitations to these investors to take their money. It's not somebody who has a job already, starts up a moonlighting job on the side, and then fudges a sign sheet or submits expense reimbursement forms that he's not entitled to get. Again, with respect to the timesheets, there is no way to determine that WBB was damaged in any manner by this time, by fraudulent timesheets. My client would deny that those timesheets were fraudulent, but taking the facts in the light most favorable to WBB, let's say that they were fraudulent, and let's say that WBB could prove down to the minute exactly how fraudulent they were. They cannot show that they lost a nickel because of any fraudulent timesheets. Not a single nickel. He's not an hourly employee. He's salaried. During the course of his employment, he raised $2.3 million. He was not fired for cause for failure to perform. He wasn't fired because he wasn't doing enough work or not generating enough business for WBB. He was fired because they found out that he had this business on the side that violated company policy. So you cannot show that there was any damage to WBB if these reports are incorrect. We know from the H.J. Inc. case that they need to set forth either a closed-ended scheme or an open-ended scheme. I pointed out that there's no open-ended scheme because there's an endpoint inside. There's no close in between because you've got one victim, it's a limited period of time, a limited variety of predicate acts, and it doesn't meet the tests that are set forth in Morgan. So we would ask the court to see this case for what it is. It's simply a dispute between an employer and an employee. WBB may have remedies in state court under fraud or under breach of fiduciary duty, but that's not the type of thing to to take this sufficiently out of the heartland of the ordinary fraud cases. And quoting from ANASCO, these are not the type of ongoing activities whose scope and persistence pose a special threat to the social well-being. It's simply not racketeering. It is, if anything, is fraud.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
Thank you,
Mr. Petrovic.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is a case that's in the summary judgment stage. Just there, we're arguing two different cases. This is not a case about 1 year and 14 expense reports, first of all. Mr. Cortling knows that this is more than 1 year and more than 14 expense reports. We have a stipulation that said that Mr. Cameron, the examples that we have on the 2008 expense reports are the same way he did it in 2007. We have his expense reports. Mr. Cortling produced them to us. We've got evidence, hard evidence, that he did the same thing, falsified expense reports in 2007. And then we got a stipulation so that we wouldn't have to go through weeks and weeks of trial on that. And now we're in the middle of the summary judgment motion, and they're misinterpreting that stipulation. The second part on the time sheets, the time reports, he was earning salary, but you're earning a salary in exchange for doing work. Mr. Cameraman may have gotten attributed new business, but as lawyers even know, it takes a team to bring in new business, and Mr. Cameraman, things you do to bring in new business happens years before it actually comes in. The damage that we have here is WBB was paying Mr. Cameraman when he was not working for them. He deceived them into believing that he was working for them, and he wasn't. Look at page 9 of our initial brief. What he was doing in February, flying to his other company, his other employer. He was going to these conferences.
What was his salary?
His salary at WBB was $165,000. During that year, he made $175,000 for his side clients. During that, and just in February alone, he flies to Vienna to work for his other company, and he bills us for the flight, 20 hours on there and 22 hours on the way back. He bills WBB, his time reports, as though he was working for WBB at conferences. The documents prove that he was working over 24 hours a day during February, and he stipulated that he did the same thing for almost three years. This is a case where he was fraudulently, he was bilking a company out of his entire compensation. That's what this case is about. And he was doing it through lying on his time reports and falsifying his time expenses. He was sending 2 and 3 expense reports out to several different companies, including us. And I think it's an extreme case, Your Honor. And I would ask that we, at the summary judgment stage, that this case is close enough to the professional's very case that we at least have a trial on this. Thank you.